Welcome to Energy Current, I'm Zhao Ang. There are two major economic measures to reduce carbon emissions of energy system, carbon pricing and industrial policy. Which one is better to deliver climate targets? On today's Energy Current podcast, I have a conversation with David Jason. David, last year in September 2022, you joined our podcast for the first time to discuss about the impact of a newly passed Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S., both domestically and internationally, the impact. You provide us a very comprehensive understanding of American historical climate laws from a perspective of a law scholar. So welcome back to Energy Current.
Thank you. Glad to be here. It was a great conversation last time, and I look forward to talking to you about this with you some more.
So Dr. David Jason is a university professor at Syracuse University College of Law. He focuses on the role of economic thought in environmental law and on constitutional law. Jason engages in public service defending democracy, environmental laws, constitutionality, and the effort to combat the climate change. So a paper which you co-author with Michael Melling, an energy policy scholar from MIT, will be published in this winter by William and Mary Environmental Law and Policy Review. Congratulations to this published publication. So the title of the paper is Pricing, Decarbonization, and Green New Deals. So we want to discuss this idea behind this paper. But firstly, would you like to give us some information on what kind of thinking brings out this paper, or what's the background? Why now? And you and the co-author, Dr. Melling, have this paper published to discuss why we need to compare the effectiveness between the carbon pricing and the industry policy.
Well, you know, as you know, I have for many decades ago actually pioneered a bit of skepticism about pricing mechanisms, especially emissions trading. Not to say that I ever thought they were worthless. I always thought they had some value and some virtues, but I thought they'd been oversold. And then particularly, they're not going to be especially good at sparking innovation. They are good at cost effectiveness and efficiently realizing whatever emission reductions were planned. But in the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of scholars have been anxious that using a system that's predominantly relying on pricing has not produced the kind of action that we need to decarbonize. And it always had more value as sort of an incremental reform to start moving in the right direction than as a means for drastic changes like we really need now with the planet heating up so fast. And so I wanted to study what these folks have been saying and think about it. And, you know, part of the story is that pricing has, achievements have been pretty modest. Pricing schemes have not had, governments have been unwilling to impose high carbon prices that would be necessary to make rapid and meaningful progress. And even in the few occasions where they have imposed high carbon prices, the achievements have been, often have been modest, even for those programs. They've gotten something, but they've been somewhat modest. And there's really good reasons of political economy to doubt that this is going to work real well, that you're going to get out of governments the kind of high prices that would might produce drastic change. And so I think the political economy's considerations sort of point to industrial policy a little more. And you know, the U.S. is the most dramatic example of that because we could not get a carbon price imposed on the federal level. We had some regional and state programs, but we were able to make progress in the Inflation Reduction Act and an infrastructure bill with a move toward industrial policy and more reliance on building infrastructure and subsidizing clean energy and other other climate measures, lots of other climate measures. And so, I think it's going to be, there are problems with that too, which we could discuss. But it seems to me more likely that that is going to be a path that might lead to decarbonization. And ideally, you do it together. You know, you could tax carbon and use that to fund industrial policy. That might be the best of both worlds.
Of course, the IRA, which was passed last year, was one of the major factors, I think, has an impact on your research. Of course, before the US, European Union and other big economies like China also used the industrial policy as a very big measurement to speed up its decarbonization. I think one of the major efforts, from the other side, like carbon pricing, is the EU ETS. This is an existing and a long-standing effort from a very big economy to fulfill the promise from the economists that, okay, and the market-based approach is more effective. So according to your research, how do you assess the function, the effectiveness of the EU ETS?
It's a matter of citing lots and lots of wind and solar, being willing to shut down coal, and running transmission line and figuring out how to manage a grid with mostly intermittent energy. And so we've had tremendous progress. And then if you look at the transportation sector, you know, the emissions trading really didn't have a lot of effect on that. Many programs don't apply to that sector, including the ETS at first. And yet we've had a lot of progress. And the way that progress came about is, again, it's a sort of a different mechanisms. You had California demanding zero emission vehicles. And then in time, the federal government and other countries around the world imitated that. Again, China, with its industrial policy, stepped in and said, well, we want a piece of this market. So they heavily subsidized electric vehicles. And now you're getting to the point where this is a viable technology, and everybody in the auto industry sees this as the future. And they're having, you know, rapid growth of zero emission vehicles. And so now we have the technological means to implement it. It's impossible whether you got this by, even if you could get this at a price, you'd have to build an infrastructure to support it. I mean, we're stuck with gasoline-fired vehicles as we have service stations to sell gasoline everywhere. So if you don't have electric vehicles, you have to have electrical power everywhere, you know, for people to get full fuel up, or at least some places, so that the countries that are serious about this are busy supporting that. And, you know, a lot of these dirty old technologies are locked in, and they're not going to be unlocked without some kind of industrial policy. So I still like pricing in some ways, but you can't get away from the need for some sort of industrial policy here.
And China is still a very typical example, because since 2005, when the country enacted the environmental law for the first time, it already built up the world's biggest renewable energy market very soon. And China employed millions and millions of people who work in these industries, like electric vehicle and other renewable power sector. But we see the EU ETS is in the fourth operation stage, and they're still adjusting itself, improving itself. And China also launched the first first national carbon market in January 2021. Many people argue it's mainly because of the pressure from the European Union. But it seems that some big economies, particularly those who have strong federal government power like EU and China, can push the carbon market forward, but not the case in the US. Do you still see the role of the carbon pricing in the near future in some economies, not like the US, but in China and in EU?
Well, you know, China and the EU and Canada at this point, and a number of other countries, have too much of an institutional commitment to these carbon pricing policies I don't think you're going to see them abandoned. I think it's more likely they'll continue. What effect they're having is difficult to judge. And this is something I discovered in researching the paper you mentioned. It's actually very hard to tease out what's causing emission reductions in the sectors that are regulated or that have a carbon price. And the reason is that no country uses a carbon price alone. They all have other, policy support mechanisms, vehicle standards, other kinds of measures. And so it's hard to tease out. I would say there isn't a lot of evidence, maybe some from the EU, but there's not a lot of strong evidence that a lot of the reductions are coming from the emissions trading. California in particular, most of the reductions are coming from something else. There's a study that says the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the northeastern United States responsible for a lot of reductions, which is a bit surprising because these reductions occurred at the time that natural gas fracking was exploding and displacing coal on economic grounds. But they did a good econometric study and showed, RGGI actually helped accelerate this quite a bit. But it's not so clear what part of RGGI, whether it's the cap and trade or the fact that they auctioned off the allowances and used those to pay for renewables and energy efficiency. So my own view is there's actually some dangers of losing emission reductions realized elsewhere in emissions trading programs. So the best approach would probably be to tax emissions and not trade them, or to cap them without trading them. Because when you trade them, what happens is you get this waterbed effect where you do a program that reduces emissions, that generates credits and justifies more emissions somewhere else. So I've come to the conclusion that the safest way to proceed is to combine industrial policy with carbon taxes or auction allowances without trading. I think that's the safest thing. Whether I'm somewhat skeptical that governments will go that way that have trading programs in place, but I think that's technically, I think that's the soundest approach. I mean, one is, it's going to be a challenge for the US and China to cooperate on climate, which would be helpful in light of the conflict, the strong conflict we have on just about across the board in so many areas. I think there's some potential for climate progress from competition. And so when the United States starts massively subsidizing its industry, I was in Canada when the Inflation Reduction Act, just after the Inflation Reduction Act passed, and the Prime Minister Trudeau said, well, we're not going to let our trading partners get advantage. We're going to subsidize our industry. And I think you're seeing the European Union think that way. And, China's been doing a lot of subsidizing all along. So you may have sort of a race to the top. So the competition may be a means of advancing the climate ball. Because the cooperation we've tried, I would say the European Union has tried. China and the U.S. have participated sometimes. The U.S. has been an erratic partner in this and not the great leader in cooperation that we were in the 70s and 80s, I'm afraid. But the cooperation has been quite imperfect. We've never been able to get agreements on significant enough concrete actions. It's been difficult. So I think we need to continue it, but competition may be a mechanism of making up for some of the failures of the cooperation. Now, that said, I'm a little worried about some of this competition interfering with global markets that can support clean energy and clean technology. Because while subsidizing might be a good thing, unfortunately, the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act has protectionist elements in it, where they're demanding North American content to some technologies in order to access some of the tax credits that are available. And that has the potential to snarl global climate supply chains, ought to make it difficult for markets to deliver with some of these technologies and make the whole enterprise more costly. And of course, one of the things that's motivating that is anxiety about China on the national security front, you know, where there's so much anxiety about that with China seemingly interested in controlling the South China Sea and threatening Taiwan and so on, that the U.S. is anxious about trading in things that can strengthen China militarily. So this lack of cooperation in global markets is spilling over into the climate area and could impede progress. But at the same time, there is potential for, you know, better structured competition to push things forward.
China already implemented this kind of specific requirements on the domestic manufactured content of the renewable technology for years and years.
Yeah.
So that's a major concern from European Union and the U.S. To criticize how China's subsidies transform the global supply chain in this area, in the renewable industries. So China is the biggest beneficiary of winner of this process in the last 20 years. So that's why the U.S. government want to follow that. And when the government want to follow that, his allies and the friends from all over the world, particularly the OECD members, they want to say, okay, if you want to do that, how about us? Do you kick us out of your market? And that's, of course, the very legitimate concern. But I think two things. First, the G7 this year already show how the major economies in the world, the most developed economies, seven economies in the world, to trying to work together to address that concerns. They want to build up a value shared club, or if you like, to pacify the worries from other countries. I mean, the U.S. Pacify the worry from the other six economies to see, okay, we can still work together to address the challenges about climate change. I will share the benefits, not only to block the market from your guys. This is one thing I would like to have your comments. How do you see this new move? Secondly, be in front of the challenges about the global supply chain and the national security concerns, which one is more important for policymakers?
Well, I don't know much about the G7 proposal, but that sounds like a good idea to try to come up with a common approach to trade in this area so that we can continue to, as we have in the past, to profit from each other's strengths and contributions to the technological solutions. On the question of the priorities of policymakers, I mean, I think the fact that those things are in the Inflation Reduction Act, that doesn't really come from the Biden administration, that comes from Joe Manson of West Virginia, but it suggests that the locus of the politics takes the national security concerns, that is the international potential of war, military concerns, more seriously than the climate concerns, right? And I think that's the way it is. And so in a situation where, you know, the U.S. sees itself as vulnerable to Chinese blockades, where China might be a, you know, a military problem in Asia, then the U.S.'s instinct is to try to move the domestic supply chains onshore. And that same move serves populist ends, which I think help explain why you're able to get something like the Inflation Reduction Act. As I mentioned at the beginning, there's a lot of economic inequality. Oh, we were talking about this before the podcast, that there's a lot of economic inequality in the U.S. And so if you can promise high-paying jobs to workers out of the energy transition, that's a helpful thing to get climate policy passed. And that's kind of, so that's a big reason that this kind of stuff is in the bill. But it's a, you know, it's a tricky process to manage because, you have to have a way of dealing with the disruption, potential disruption of war. That's a legitimate concern. I mean, when when Russia invaded Ukraine and German energy prices went up, they promptly started some coal-fired power plants. And Germany has been a great, you know, good actor on climate change for a long time, which with those kind of pressures on countries, it's hard for them to stick to what they need to do on the climate front.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Sometimes I think the policymakers always take some disruptive factor into their metrics to consider how they respond to the challenges and the policy challenges. So I have another question about thing about the disruption or some uncertainty. You know, industrial policy, if it's successful, is always based on the economic situation. So if you have a very fast growth economy, the government has a leverage to produce incentives, financial support, tax credits. I think this is a basic assumption. If your economy is not well growth, and very low increase rates every year, it's hard to see how can you move more resources to support the renewables and other low carbon industries. So that's why I think for the EU, as one of the most successful economies in the world, and also China is the fastest growing economy, and the US the biggest one, those economies, they have their leverage to issue the industry policies to support the decarbonization. But the situation seems to me is changing. You know, the US has been struggling with the inflation for a while, but now the economy is kind of a soft landing. I think the employment rate is very high, unemployment rate is very low. And although the average price of the consumer goods is relatively higher, but the economy shape is pretty good. But European is still in the big impact of the Russia invasion, the Ukraine, and the high energy price. And China specifically is in a very big trouble in terms of economic downturn. So when China is in this kind of situation, it not only bring its own domestic problem, but also maybe have some spillover impact on the neighboring countries, the low-income countries, in terms of helping them to grow and build up the energy system. So if China expand its dependence on domestic coal, as German had done after the Russia invasion Ukraine last year, and rather than importing more natural gas, I mean, for China, rather than importing more natural gas to accelerate its process of phasing out coal from now to 2030. What do you think the other partners, other big players would react in this fight, in this area? I mean, China's action not speeding up, but slowing down.
Well, that would be a disaster. I mean, China's a very huge source of carbon emissions. I think the largest in the world at this point. I don't think it would have a huge effect on other countries. I mean, I think Germany's going to want to get away from coal as soon as it can, but I see this as a temporary thing. The U.S., we are so consumed with internal fights, it's hard to see that having a whole lot of effect. I mean, the fact is we have abundant natural gas. We have low-priced renewables. It's uneconomic to keep coal-fired power plants running. So I don't see us suddenly starting to do that just because China decided to do it. I don't see that as likely. But on the other hand, we have, you know, a lot of what we have is utilities hanging on to natural gas, and they should be moving to renewables in some areas where there isn't strong state support for the renewables. But so I don't see it as having a huge impact on other countries, but the significance of China alone doing something like that is just enormous. I mean, it's just the, you know, this is a crisis right now, this climate emergency we're in, and we really need to get to zero carbon. I think we need to do it before 2050, but we can't even seem to manage it by 2050. And if we start going to...
So as I said, the burning fire of the climate change is an issue. I mean, for many people, they say, okay, this is the most urgent challenge for humankind. But we have to think about the opposition view. So I would like to cite Dr. Stephen Coney, who is now a professor in New York University, who served Under Secretary of the Energy Department under the Obama administration for years. So he argues that there are still some uncertainties surrounding the climate change science, particularly the sea, not many data, sufficient data to see how the ocean and play a role in the climate change, how to really measure the ocean's impact on the climate change. The other thing is about a lot of the extreme weather events, they are mainly driven by the short-term factors, not the long-term climate change. So this is the second argument. The third one is about the whole world has been improving its capacity in terms of the livelihood and the technology and economically the capacity to improve our well-being in the last half century. It's a dramatic and amazing achievement for the whole world. Of course, China play a big role in that. So he mentioned maybe we have strong capacity to adapt the impact of climate change. How do you respond to those arguments by Dr. Stephen Coney?
Well, the temperature has risen at a greater rate than was predicted a number of years ago. And the reason I think that that's happened is that scientists tend to be conservative and not want to overstate things. And the data is always limited. So he's right, there's uncertainty. I don't think he's right about anything else from what you just said. That is, there is uncertainty, but that means that things could be worse than we imagine, not just better. That's why I'm worried about waiting to 2050 to get to zero emissions, because the record has been, for the most part, there have been some other, it's not a uniform picture, but for a number of phenomena, things have been happening faster than we thought. I mean, I remember when, you know, the Environmental Defense Fund said, oh, the West Antarctica ice sheet will never melt. That's not true. That can't happen. It's happening. We see Indonesia underwater. We see wildfires in Canada like we've never seen before. And all these things. And he's right that there are a number of factors. It's not all climate disruption, but basically the predictions of the models have been, we'll see more heat waves, we'll see more droughts, we'll see more flooding, we'll see more intense storms. And by God, that's what's happening. Now you can, you know, your ability to attribute each of these phenomena directly to climate change is limited by the, you know, sort of the limits of data. But the sensible interpretation of the overall picture is we're in a crisis and climate change is a big factor in that, and it's going to make things worse. And now in terms of adaptation, I think our ability to do that is quite limited. I think we should do everything we can to adapt. But you just saw Lahaina in Hawaii burn to the ground. I was in that city 2 years ago. It's a beautiful place. It's been a capital of Hawaii back historically. It's just an amazing place. And it was something that people thought might be exacerbated by climate change, drying out the grasses. And this is an advanced country, but nobody took the adaptive measures that would be called for, such as burn utility lines or having plans in place to shut down the power grid in the event of high winds or any of this stuff that would have protected it. We had Katrina put New Orleans underwater. And everybody with any sense said, well, we never should build that back. We have to move. We can't build there again. Well, we rebuilt it. Because the political, it's easy to say adapt, but when you talk, you're trying to force people to make huge changes in their lives and abandon the coastlines, it's very hard. So you end up with half measures like seawalls and you do things, but the worse it gets, the more limited our ability to adapt is. See, this is the problem. Adaptation is at best a partial solution. It's never going to make up for limiting the warming. It can ameliorate it, but it's never going to prevent all these things from occurring. And so I share his optimism about technology. I mean, we've seen it in the renewable energy space. We've seen it in electric vehicles. I'm sure we'll see it in adaptation measures as well. But that doesn't mean that we can politically organize to use it optimally. And some of these adaptation measures are very, very complicated and hard to implement, require major lifestyle changes and emergency management systems and so on. And so I absolutely think there are going to be some improvements. I hate to say this, but this is an emergency and our ability to manage it is limited. We'll do something about that. We should do more, but we need to, at the same time, we're ramping up our emergency response capabilities. We need to reduce the danger.
So as a Euro, I would like to invite you to recommend a nonfiction book to our audience and to our listeners.
I read a book called Riverman, An American Odyssey. And it's a book about an interview with a guy who traveled the whole United States on rivers for years. And it's just fascinating. And I sort of came to this because, you know, I used to backpack a lot when I was young, but I'm getting older and I'm not sure it's the best thing for my knees, but I still like to get into the wilderness. So the way I do this these days, I go on rafting trips. They go pretty deep in the wilderness. I started with a 12-day trip in the Grand Canyon. So it's fascinating to me that this guy would get out in water and just follow rivers everywhere.
Okay. David, thank you so much for sharing your research and recommending this book. It's such a pleasure to have a conversation with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks very much.
So, dear listeners, thank you for listening to this podcast. Energy Current is a podcast focused on climate change and energy transition policy discussion. By having conversation with experts and scholars around the world, this podcast may inform a more reasonable debate on seeking a future of a zero energy system. We have produced more than 80 episodes since 2020, when we are still in the pandemic. You may find us on a variety of podcast platforms from Spotify to Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. If you have any questions or suggestions on our program, please contact us with the email energycurrentconversation@gmail.com. If you like this podcast, please share with your friends and colleagues. I'm John. See you next time.